Hey, if you were applying for a job, would you publicly discredit the other candidates as a strategy to get the job yourself?
We know Patricia Madrid has ignored corruption, but it gets worse.
Heather Wilson is on the Intelligence Committee, but she never questioned George Bush on the war. That's not independence. Not by a long shot.
Why is this technique used by people who run for political office, including the U.S. presidency? And why is political discourse in general so contentious and conflict-ridden?
Now, Bush is a champion of hate and divisiveness.
The president. We love the president.
I don't hate him.
You do hate him.
No,
you
should not say that we're full of hate.
We live in a political world where peace is not welcome at all. It's turned away from the door, the one that's small, or put up against the wall.
Welcome to today's special program, Seeking Civility in Political Discourse.
We live in a political world where peace is not welcome at all. It's turned away from the door, the one that's small, or put up against the wall.
How would you rate civility or the tone of political discourse in the U.S. these days?
I think it's hostile and angry this year. People are upset.
In general, how do you feel about the way people talk to each other about politics?
I feel good about it because, you know, they really express their views and they're really strong about them, and then they listen, you know, you talk to each other, and sometimes they sway, because I'm swayed sometimes. I was swayed from one party to another, so who knows, you know.
There's a lot of mudslinging back and forth, really negative in both ways, and I don't particularly understand why it has to be like that, because we're not really facing the issues.
Is there anything that you think citizens could do? Any ideas about what citizens could do to change that tone?
I don't think we can do anything about it. I think it's out of the citizens' hands, unfortunately. At this point, it becomes a political machine. It has very little to do with the citizens anymore. And that's unfortunate.
I'm Suzanne Kreider. Today we'll explore whether we're stuck with incivility or if citizens can work for change to promote more peaceful politics. Our three guests today will help us explore these issues. Kate Nelson is managing editor of the Albuquerque Tribune and host of In Focus on Albuquerque's PBS affiliate, KNME-TV. Dr. Gilbert St. Clair is a lecturer in political science at the University of New Mexico and co-author of The Image is Everything Presidency, Dilemmas in American Leadership. And in the studios of KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, is Dr. Guy Burgess, co-director of the Conflict Research Consortium at the University of Colorado. Welcome to each of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me ask each of you in a minute or less to start out by giving us a quick assessment of what you feel the tone of our political discourse in America is today. Now, that's between politicians or even among citizens. Kate, we'll start with you.
It's different depending on who's doing the talking. I think among politicians, it's pretty hot. It's not the hottest it's ever been, but it certainly could be a lot better, a lot more focused on issues that matter. Among the electorate, I think there are two things going on. There's a sort of a moderate muddle in the middle, which is, in fact, a majority of people who are taking politics pretty seriously or are somewhat apathetic about them but aren't speaking about them in civil terms. And then there's the anger at the edges, the people who are listening to the hot-toned punditry and mimicking it in their dinner table conversations as well as perhaps their driving behaviors and what else that they might participate in society.
Gil?
Well, certainly amongst the politicians today, we have a very partisan division and some bitterness generated by that. This is not unheard of in American politics. We can go back to 1789, the beginning of the Republic, and find a very vituperative contention amongst the politicians. But I quite agree with Kate that amongst the electorate today, there is the moderates who are a little confused, I think, about all this bitterness. But the sort of left and right have a very, very keen difference over political values. and the proper role of government, which occasionally is expressed in uncivil terms.
And Guy, what would you add to that?
Well, we have a highly escalated political conflict in the United States, and one of the things that happens as the escalation process proceeds is that a substantive discussion of the merits of the issues involved tends to disappear and be replaced by a level of intense hostility between the groups, really, and almost a complete unwillingness to believe that either side has real points that are worth making.
So before we talk about the history of incivility, how this all got started, why should Americans care about this topic? Is there damage being done?
One of the easiest ways you can say yes, damage is being done is by looking at voter turnout. Fewer and fewer people care to take part in a process that appears distasteful, that appears to leave them and their concerns out in the cold. And that's what we've been charting now over at least the last 30 years.
What does it look like? What's the chart say in terms of percentages, or is it a huge difference?
Yes. If we take the long look at voter turnout in presidential elections, which is the highest turnout of any of our elections, nearly half of the eligible voters are not participating in the process.
And so, Guy, you mentioned that we're losing the substantive discussions. What's the damage in that, or what other negative impact is there from incivility?
Well, what happens with this kind of escalation, the focus becomes on winning the election, and all of the discussion is on really hot-button campaign tactics designed to move the very few swing voters that remain. So you find that the election focuses on a few issues which are a long way from the really difficult problems that face the country. So the real issues fall off the political agenda altogether. And the ultimate result is that we wind up making a lot of bad decisions. And those over time are going to prove pretty costly, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start a discussion by really looking at discourse between politicians. Let's keep citizens out of it for now. Gil, let's start with you and get some history. You mentioned that this goes back as far as 1789. What was it in terms of the discourse between politicians that was so bad?
Well, there were deep divisions of political values between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists in the whole ratification of the Constitution. That carries on to the Federalist Party and then the Jeffersonian Republicans, who had very different political values and who felt every bit as strongly about them as we find today in these differences. Each had their own press, their own newspapers, which they supported. And the press had a material interest in sort of continuing the bitterness of the contest and attempting to win elections.
Well, explain that. Why? What was their material interest?
Well, the party that wins the elections grants the government contracts for printing, and so the press that supported the winning party gets the contracts.
But just between the politicians, I'd read recently that even the Lincoln-Douglas debates were nasty. Were they yelling at each other or calling each other names? Or?
Well, if they weren't shouting, they were at least using words that were emotive. But there is an adverse element to this. It's one thing to be have attack ads and be negative in the campaign. But once the campaigns are over and people assume office, then policy must be made. And courtesy is sort of the oil of politics in policymaking. And if you have inflamed the environment in your electoral campaign, then civility and courtesy are hard to institute in the process of making policy, which in a democracy requires compromise and negotiation.
Okay. Well, let's fast forward way into the 1970s. And, Kate, I want to ask you about the Watergate era, because Jerome Zeifman served as chief counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during the Watergate era. And he says that televising the Watergate hearings really augmented this partisanship. It was the first time that we got to see congressional members questioning people and that they felt pressured to make really partisan questions. He really feels like that's where the incivility started. What's your take on that?
He might be right about that, and I'll be honest, I haven't thought about that as deeply as he has. My feeling has always been that televising those hearings was a wonderful lesson in civics to a lot of Americans who'd never seen Congress in action before. And of an issue of such magnitude, it helped heighten the fact that this is important. You must pay attention to this.
Okay. Guy, how about you? What's your take on the Watergate hearings?
There's an interesting Bill Moyers special that traces back the way in which a war was handled in the media since the turn of the century, really. And you see with Watergate and Vietnam a rise in a much more critical look at what government does. And you start to see reporting of the motives behind particular tactics used by political parties. And I think that's kind of a step in the right direction. But you get to the point where nobody can do anything right because there's always an ulterior motive. And that might contribute, I think, to the general distrust in the political process, though there are certainly lots of other problems as well.
Right. So, Guy Burgess, I have a question for you about the definition of civility. I found this definition from John Locke. He says, civility is nothing but outward expressing of goodwill and esteem, or at least of no contempt or hatred. Is civility about being polite?
Well, that's a kind of narrow definition. I think if we decide that that's all it is, we will have really missed the point. I mean, it isn't civil to say, excuse me, please, while I stab you in the back. And civility also doesn't really imply an immunity from negative campaigns. You really need to be able to raise the tough issues. It's not a synonym for weakness either, though with this whole flap over sensitivity, I think it's being used tactically that way. What it really boils down to is a commitment to honesty and truthfulness and a genuine effort to portray the various issues honestly and not using deceptive kind of lying with statistics tactics. It also implies, I think, at some level an altruistic motive. It isn't pure selfish competition, the notion that the invisible fist of pure competition will lead to good policy probably isn't true. Or actually, I should correct that. The notion that the invisible hand of pure competition will lead to good policy. The danger is that there's an invisible fist, and without some level of altruism and commitment to persuade one another, you wind up making bad decisions.
Kate Nelson?
I find a lot of value in that. I worry that when we bemoan the lack of civility in political discourse, that there's some sort of Pollyanna-ish desire for everyone to get along with everyone. And there's something very positive in the rough and tumble of politics. People do have widely divergent ideas, and they are valid ideas. There's not a right and a wrong. There's just differences of opinions. And the beauty of American democracy is the freedom to debate it out. And debate need not mean that we are cloaking our emotions and our words and the true extent of our feelings. We just need to figure out some way to carry out that rough and tumble debate and keep it on the issue. And too often, I guess, what we really are bemoaning is that we're talking about image, we're talking about the secondary issues, we're making up issues, we're diverting attention rather than focusing it on where it needs to be.
Right, so focus on the problem, not the people. Mm. But it seems like so much of the campaigning is about this polarization of one personality versus another personality. And they're always described in real extremes rather than sort of in shades of gray. I'm wondering if politicians have always, you know, felt this need to appear radically different from one another.
Well, I'm not sure they've always felt that. But at various points in our history where, you know, there are very strong feelings and very deep divisions over policies and so on. Well, we can talk about slavery. That occupied us for the first 60 years of the Republic, and feelings were very strong. I'm concerned, though, that if a democracy is to work, there must be a fundamental trust by citizens and office holders that their opponents are basically well-meaning and that they are rational and that they understand that there are other interests at issue and compromise must be made. When we lose that and when we become sort of demeaning or even dehumanizing or demonizing, I guess I should say, our opponents, then I think democracy is under serious threat.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to a special program exploring civility in political discourse. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Our guests are Albuquerque Tribune Managing Editor Kate Nelson, Dr. Gilbert St. Clair, a lecturer in political science at the University of New Mexico, and Dr. Guy Burgess, co-director of the Conflict Research Consortium at the University of Colorado. I'd like to read a quote from House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and have each of you give it a civility rating. And she's referring to George W. Bush this way. She says, quote, "The emperor has no clothes. I believe the president's leadership in the action taken in Iraq demonstrates an incompetence in terms of knowledge, judgment, and experience in making the decisions that would have been necessary to truly accomplish the mission without the deaths to our troops and the cost to our taxpayers." End quotes. So some would say that use of the word incompetence is uncivil. Guy, what's your rating?
Well, it's certainly not the kind of political discourse that you'd like to have. Asking a question like that, you need to think about the context in which the statement was made, the degree to which you're striving for quotable quotes to show up as a soundbite on the evening news, the degree to which you're responding to similar tactics on the other side. But I think it's clear that once we get a political debate to this level, not much in the way of real discussion of options is going to happen.
Kate, how would you rate that?
I think that's fair. It's based on his public performance, and I think she can point to examples where she could see failed foreign policy, and seems like a fair shot to me.
And Gil St. Clair, how would you rate that?
Well, I would say that it certainly is emotionally based. Incompetence conjures a negativity that perhaps would need to be explained. What was the alternative? What would she say were the wrong decisions? What would have been a right decision is not there. It's simply a statement of incompetence. And I would say that leads to incivility.
Mm-hmm. But Kate, you don't see it that way because you see incompetence.
I'm seeing you pulling one quote out of what was probably a much longer statement. And in fact, perhaps those options were stated there. And I'm hoping that they were. And as I stated in originally, that she could cite examples of where she saw failed foreign policy. And if in fact can do so and recommend the alternative, yeah, that's fair game in the political world.
Okay. How about other examples? Can you all call up any glaring examples of what a politician has said that was really uncivil?
Well, Mr. Cheney on the Senate floor was perhaps overstepping a line there, presumably a private conversation, but resorting to obscenities and such as crossing a line.
Mm-hmm. Guy Burgess?
Well, I'd raise a different kind of statement, one that's deliberately misleading, where you take a quote out of context or a vote out of context, and you twist it around so it becomes evidence of something that just isn't true. There are a whole series of deceptive tactics and subtle innuendos and that sort of thing that maybe aren't as spectacular and obvious as using insulting language, but they can be far more insidious, I think.
That's a really good point, and particularly in for any candidate who has spent time in Congress, there's a ready-made field to play in on that. The patchwork nature of so much legislation means that you can take one component of a very complicated piece of legislation and say, look what he voted for or against, and have nowhere in there an explanation of, yeah, he kind of had to because it was attached to this other very important piece of legislation. And that's become a hallmark of congressional and presidential campaigns.
Yeah, that reminds me, I was reading about the congressional civility retreats that Mark Garzone was the chief organizer and mediator. And he said that he was really surprised with the relationships that had developed between Democrats and Republicans. And here's a quote. There was an enormous amount of what I witnessed there was about revenge. You would ask Republicans why they would trash the Democrats, and they would say, quote, well, when they were in the majority, they did that to us, and now we're going to do that to them. Of course they want to change it now. They want to be civil now when they're in the minority, end quotes. I'm curious if this, the very nature of a two-party system really perpetuates the incivility and lack of collaboration.
Well, there again, I think it depends on historical times. I mean, at times the partisanship has been very bitter and uncivil. At other times, particularly in wartime, there has been a bipartisanship. Also, we've seen a change, at least since World War II until perhaps the late 60s, in the distribution of ideology in the two parties. I mean, there was a time there were liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats, and so that the political values were not as sharply divided partisan-wise as they are today, but there were existed in both parties, in which case there was a basis, an ideological basis for a cooperation between the parties.
Kate, what's your sense about this feud between the two parties?
That it's real and that it's getting, I presume it will continue to get worse. Imagine after 4 years of Republican complaining about a minority of Democrats in the Senate holding up political appointments, and particularly of federal judges, if in this election a Democrat wins. Will the Republicans be putting the fast track on all of those Democratic appointments to those same offices? My guess is no, that the stonewalling now will go over to their side and will ping-pong it back and forth in perpetuity. And that's not good. It hasn't been good for the judiciary. It hasn't been good for federal agencies that are getting by on acting this and acting that. And I don't see on the horizon any quick fix to that.
And Guy, you're really an expert in conflict resolution. I'm curious if you see, does it dilute the conflict a little bit to have more than two parties, say if you had multiple party system with three or four smaller parties?
Well, you'd have to change the voting rules, really, in order to have I think for multiple parties to be stable. If you want to win an election, you've got to be in one party or the other. There's, unlike a parliamentary system where you can get some seats in parliament with, say, 5% of the votes, you can't do that here. I'm not sure that changing the party structure by moving to a parliamentary system would necessarily fix things. There's an image that I keep coming back to of politics as a pendulum, and it swings back and forth. The problem is that when it's coming your way, people have the tendency to grab it and pull it as far as they can, forgetting that that means it's going to swing back even further the other way. And I think we are getting to a level where there's increased intensity and both parties are maybe moving a little more to greater extremes, the Republicans probably more than Democrats.
Mm. All right, Guy, I have another historic quote for you. John Adams said, "Let not writers nor statesmen deceive themselves. The springs of their own conduct and opinions are not always so clear and pure, nor are those of their antagonists in politics always so polluted and corrupted. Mere readers and private persons can see virtues and talents on each side." So, Guy, you suggest that a crucial element of civility is when one of the conflicting parties can admit, hey, I'm wrong, or hey, my opponent has a better idea. Are you suggesting that a politician should embrace the flip-flop?
Well, the danger is the sacrifice trap, where once you've made sacrifices or asked your constituents to make sacrifices, you can't admit that it was a mistake. And you wind up getting committed to stupid policies over long periods of time. And the truth of the matter is the world is a really complicated, messy place, and people make decisions that don't turn out the way they expect all the time. And if we don't let people change their mind, then we're going to get stuck with a lot of not-so-good policies.
Well, where does that come from, you guys? Why can't, I mean, we let people in our personal lives change their minds. I mean, we might be upset about it, but this just seems ridiculous that we don't let our leaders change their minds.
Well, this is a place where I think the media and me as part of it are going to have to fall on a sword. In a conversation I had recently with a reader, she in fact stated her forgiving nature for the flip-flop, as you put it, that to her that's a sign of a person in evolution. And as events change around them, they change their mind, and that can be a good thing. The problem, I think, the thing that holds back a politician from saying that is because the bombast is so immediate and so loud from the talk radio shows, from the TV roundtable screaming matches, from the opposing candidates' campaign ad machinery, that anymore they can have an ad on the air within 24 hours and be running it every 15 minutes. And it's that constant nyeh, right back at the person who may have very sincerely changed their mind on a good point for good reasons. If you're going to face that kind of backlash, you're going to think twice about doing it, whether you're in the political realm or if it's in the kitchen in the middle of a discussion with your spouse. I'll avoid the argument. I'll stay the course.
I might say that part of the blame for this must rest with the voters, with the citizens. I think if our citizens were more engaged, they would be more appreciative of the fact that political leaders may change their minds when they get more information or when they see what Guy has raised. There are unexpected consequences of policy. There are always unexpected consequences of policies that may result in a change. And I think we need a more sophisticated, attentive citizenry, and we wouldn't have as much emphasis, perhaps, on the sort of soundbite and negative.
We're coming to the end of part one of our program on civility in political discourse. We've talked about the history and a bit about how politicians engage with each other. We'll have more with Kate Nelson of the Albuquerque Tribune, Dr. Guy Burgess of the University of Colorado, and Dr. Gil St. Clair of the University of New Mexico in part two of our program. You'll be able to hear both parts of our program and link to other resources online at peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. Our program is produced by Good Radio Shows Incorporated. Producer and engineer is Paul Ingalls. Engineering assistance from Joel Edelstein and KGNU, Boulder, Colorado. Music by Bob Dylan and Ali Adelman. I'm Suzanne Kreider, and you're listening to Civility in Political Discourse. Hope you can join us for part two. Welcome to part two of a special program, Seeking Civility in Political Discourse.
The only answer, really, is to provide for people to be able to go to college.
Giving up our best jobs, the manufacturing jobs.
We're not talking about getting
on. What did you just say?
Look, I forgot what I just said.
Right. If you listen to talk radio, it's horrible. Talk radio is primarily responsible for causing a huge deterioration in the level of discourse. It is angry. It is full of misinformation.
It concerns me because people are reacting to bumper sticker type slogans and are not looking behind those slogans to the details of the issues.
What do you think citizens could do about this?
Nothing. It's like money is what does it.
We live in a political world. Turning in a thrashing about. As soon as you awake, you're trade to take what looks like the easy way out.
I'm Suzanne Kreider. Why is political discourse in the United States, in general, so contentious and conflict-ridden? Americans are often characterized as at war with each other. Are we stuck with incivility, or can citizens work for change and promote more peaceful politics? In part one of our program, we talked about the history of the tone of political discourse in the United States. In this half, we'll delve more into campaign advertising, the role of the media in political discourse, and efforts to bring more civility to politics. Our three panelists are Kate Nelson, the managing editor of the Albuquerque Tribune and host of In Focus on Albuquerque's PBS affiliate, KNME-TV. Dr. Gilbert St. Clair, a lecturer in political science at the University of New Mexico and co-author of The Image is Everything Presidency, Dilemmas in American Leadership. And in the studios of KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, is Dr. Guy Burgess, co-director of the Conflict Research Consortium at the University of Colorado. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So the American Museum of Moving Images has an archive of presidential campaign ads at their website. It's really fun to take a look back into the 50s. Let's listen to some excerpts from several of the campaigns over the years.
You like Geithner, I like Geithner. Everybody likes Geithner for president. Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Geithner to Washington. We got to get where we are going. Travel day and night for president. Let Adelaide go the other way. We'll all go with Geithner.
When Illinois, the GOP double cross. He is the one who told all the crooks, get lost. Adley, love you madly.
Kennedy!
Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but not so doggone seasoned that he won't try something new? A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well,
how can a party that can't unite itself unite the nation? How can a party that can't keep order in its own backyard hope to keep order in our 50 states?
Where does Richard Nixon stand on the UN treaty to stop the spread of nuclear weapons? He says he's in no hurry to pass it. Hubert Humphrey wants to stop the spread of nuclear weapons now.
We've seen walls built around Washington. And we feel like we can't quite get through to guarantee the people of this country a government that's sensitive to our needs.
Jimmy Carter, a leader for a change.
The smoothest of Iran's diplomatic criminals was shown on American television this weekend, warning American voters that they had better not elect Ronald Reagan. Ayatollah Khomeini and his men prefer a weak and manageable U.S. president and have decided to do everything in their power to determine our election result.
Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times.
George Bush talks a lot about prison furloughs. But he won't tell you that the Massachusetts program was started by a Republican and stopped by Mike Dukakis.
Bob Dole voted against reimbursing California for jailing illegal immigrants.
Time magazine says his risky tax scheme could cut 2,000 border agents, cut 4,000.
Secondly, I believe oftentimes campaigns resort to mud throwing and name calling, and Americans are sick of that kind of campaigning. What they want to hear is what's on people's minds and where the candidates' hearts are.
I hear some people say, you know, this election doesn't really matter. It does matter. Our air and water are at stake, and I need your help to protect them.
Well, it looks like we've lost a lot of those delightful jingles from our political campaigns.
What a shame that is.
So what's interesting to note about the history of political advertising over the last half century? Kate?
I think primarily is that people became more sophisticated in how to use that medium, those early campaign ads with the jingles. What was on TV back then but variety programs? They were just mimicking what you saw in your general programming, and they became more sophisticated in how to put images together, how to orchestrate underneath and then over them, and then that those sneering voiceovers that they could add. I swear there's only two people, a man and a woman, working in campaign TV advertising these days. I'd love to meet them sometime because they're raking it in, and they can hear, he voted for, and that's the primary thing we're seeing in the snippets that we just saw there is the sophistication in how to manipulate the 30-second, the 15-second advertisement. I thought it was interesting that the one of Bush in there doing the soft ad. People are tired of the negative campaigning. There's that push-pull that they do in their ads where they're usually hands-off on the one that is negative, although now they do have to say, I approve this ad, and then they're out of the way. But then the ones that do feature them, they're the candidate who's calling for an end to this divisiveness. They're the good candidate. They're the one listening to you, and they all do it.
And Guy, what else did you notice?
Well, I think that the big change is this increasing sophistication and understanding of the dynamics of how to structure a focus group, how to demographically analyze an electorate, how you figure out what issues it takes to move the target group of swing voters that you're after, what issues to avoid. And it's really fairly impressive and sophisticated. Unfortunately, I don't think it's very good for our democracy.
Why not?
It tends to take you away from the real issues. You wind up focusing the election on the hot-button issues that might move an election result and avoiding the issues that the society really ought to be grappling with.
Mm-hmm. And Gil St. Clair, what else did you notice in the tone?
Well, I think that sequence of ads that were played after the jingle phase, we had some substantive issues in those ads. Issues of nuclear proliferation and other issues, fairly sophisticatedly stated. And then we end up with the Willie Horton ad, which is, pretty blatantly outrageous, but was extremely effective. So I think we have seen that sort of change. There aren't any ads, though, there in that sequence which I think represent the most effective positive ads, and those were the Reagan ads.
Mm-hmm.
They were very sophisticated, and they had this upbeat feeling, morning in America, and yet there was frequently a negativity portrayed in them that was very effective to the opponent without ever saying that.
Right.
It's morning again in America. Today, more men and women will go to work than ever before in our country's history. With interest rates at about half the record highs of 1980, nearly 2,000 families today will buy new homes, more than at any time in the past 4 years. This afternoon, 6,500 young men and women will be married. And with inflation at less than half of what it was just 4 years ago, they can look forward with confidence to the future. It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than 4 short years ago?
So we've had great sophistication. Now, I come back to my point that, unfortunately, these ads tend to work because a great number of Americans take their political information from them. And so getting the sort of counterweight to them or getting a frame in which to view these ads is not often there.
You know, and some people believe that a campaign ad should really focus on why I should vote for a candidate as opposed to why I shouldn't vote for the opponent. But why do attack ads really work?
Well, I think they work because, again, there's a lot of folks not paying much attention, and something that sort of grabs you while you're not paying much attention may be effective. And I'm not sure that at least we political scientists understand why the attack ads work so well, despite the fact that citizens say they don't like negative advertising, although there's a distinction between negative and attack ads. And it is legitimate to use ads which actually deal with substantive issues, past records, mm-hmm. performance of an official that may be subject to critique by
an
opponent.
So that's the difference between negative and attack?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, there are some rules that you've got to employ if you're going to use these successfully. What you put in that negative or attack ad has got to be true. Can't be refuted clearly or you lose all credibility. And it can't be personal because that begins to elicit an emotion of sympathy for the person you're attacking.
You're listening to a special program exploring civility in political discourse. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Our guests are Albuquerque Tribune Managing Editor Kate Nelson, Dr. Guy Burgess, co-director of the Conflict Research Consortium at the University of Colorado, and Dr. Gil St. Clair, a lecturer in political science at the University of New Mexico. Hey, Guy, I'm curious about what role the media plays just in the general polarization, and I'm really curious about language, because language has an impact about how we think about things. So I want to read a quote from a headline, the Albuquerque Journal, July 31st. It says, election 2004, gloves are off. And then the article reads, the candidates, quote, wasted no time blasting each other Friday at the official start of the general election campaign. So, Guy, language is really powerful. Do you think the media tries to turn elections into boxing matches?
Well, there's certainly a competitive dynamic where the media needs to present things in an interesting way that attracts readers, and we've heard that that there's some problem attracting readers and listeners. So there's a tendency to do that.
Well, Kate, how about you? Do you think that if the Albuquerque Tribune got some feedback from its readers about the kind of language it used, would that have any impact on the way you all write headlines?
Definitely. We take our readers' comments very seriously. And things like headlines, yeah, we pay a lot of attention to those. We're trying to get people to pick that newspaper up off the rack, and it's got to have some pop to them as they're walking by on their way to the grocery store. That said, we also don't want to be selling them on a story that doesn't deliver or that over-sensationalizes or creates an emotional reaction that is unwarranted given the nature of the story.
But why does it have to be a boxing match? I mean, they don't have gloves on. They're not.
Well, those are,
punching
you know what,
each
to
other.
Be honest, those are cliche terms among political reporters who fall into there's this side, there's that side, they're fighting, they're dueling, they're, you know, there's a winner, there's a loser. One of the ones that I'm warring against in my own newsroom is this labeling of New Mexico and other states as battleground states.
Right.
This isn't a war. There are no weapons. No one will die at the end of it. We are simply a swing state. But battleground state is this new sexy term, and that comes from the campaigns. And the media picks up on it, and I'm fighting a losing war over it.
Right. Gil?
This is not totally new in American politics. Alexis de Tocqueville, the Frenchman who toured the country in 1833, wrote that American campaigns were all about sport and spectacle.
Mm.
So, you know, sort of the excitement of the campaign and the sporting aspects of it have been a part of our campaigns for a very long time.
Guy Burgess.
I think a bigger problem is what you might call the narrowcasting phenomena. With the proliferation of news sources with cable and the internet and all of that, it's pretty easy to find a news source that tells you exactly what you want to hear. And when you're thinking about the really difficult issues that face the world, it's really nice to have somebody and to spend some time with a community where you feel that you're right and everybody else is wrong. So we have both on the left and the right talk shows like Rush Limbaugh's that tend to reinforce the views of the listeners and further drive the polarization of the entire society and take us away from the real discussion of the issues. And to be fair, the same sort of dynamic occurs on both the left and the right.
So
we don't really have good settings where we really have to reconcile competing views. We can live in different areas.
So what you're saying is we actually choose our news outlet based on the language that we like to hear, the way we like language used. And I'm also extrapolating that you're suggesting that people should balance sort of their media diet.
That
be true?
Make good sense, sure.
Yeah, okay. Hey, I'd like to get to a hopeful example. It's run by the St. Paul Women's League of Voters, and it's called the Minnesota Compact. The Minnesota Compact started in 1996. It was a project out of the Humphrey Institute and their Center for the Study of Politics. And at that time, they set a standard for four areas of political campaigns: candidate debates, campaign advertising, media coverage, and also citizen participation. And we'll put more about this on our website so that you all can get the link to that. Listeners can find out more about the Minnesota Compact. But what they're doing is they're having very specific behaviors that they expect not only from candidates, but also from the media and from the citizenry. So they're trying to hold each other all accountable for these different standards. And let me just read a couple of them to you. Let me read one of the items on the citizen participation checklist. Let candidates know which issues you think are important and ask them to address the issues fairly and squarely. And Guy, that's really what you've been talking about, that we lose the substantive issues. Do you think this would work if people called up their candidates and said, hey, I really want you to talk about health care?
I think if you had a significant portion of the electorate actively supporting something like this, it would go a long ways towards promoting more constructive political campaigns.
Why is that?
Well, I think that it changes the structure of the discussion. It removes some of the tactical advantage for what you might call dirty tricks campaigning, and it provides some real recognition and advantage to politicians that take a more constructive approach. In a sense, what you're organizing is a political action group that would support constructive campaigns on either side. And that would be a very interesting thing to try to do.
Gil St. Clair, how useful do you think this would be?
Well, I think it'd be wonderful. But I think it also depends on the political culture of the constituency you're dealing with. If we look at Minnesota or Wisconsin, we're finding what Daniel Elazar called the moralistic political culture, where the prevailing view is that government is about making things better for the whole society, creating the just society. There are other political cultures who view politics as the way to get ahead in the world, to improve your social and economic position, not about ideas. It's about jobs and contracts. And so the St. Paul idea is one of good citizenship and good politics. Wouldn't play in some other places.
Hmm. So Minnesotans are more evolved than the rest of the United States?
Well, it all depends what you want government to do.
Mm.
If your view is government should be about making the just society, then yes, this is they're more evolved. On the other hand, if you want government not to bother with those kinds of aspects, but to simply deal with the sort of minimum things of government, and you want to use government as a way to improve your own life, that's a different culture.
Okay. Here's another example, the conflict-resolving government. This is out of Australia. It asks every politician in federal, state, or local government to make four commitments. One of them is, I will address the issues and refrain from making personal attacks on my opponents. Kate, you think that would work in the United States?
Yes, I do. I think also that every politician would say, well, I already do that. It's my opponent who won't. So getting them to first become self-aware of their own behavior and how it's impacting the process would be the big first hurdle you'd have to cross.
We're coming to the end of our program. We didn't get to cover everything in this complex topic. For example, we didn't talk about the impact that campaign finance reform and free political airtime could have on campaign ads and on political discourse. We didn't spend much time on partisan columnists or pundits, but our time is up, and I'd like to thank our guests for everything that we did cover. It was very illuminating. And would each of you, I hate to say it, share a soundbite about what you feel is the most important piece to remember about improving political dialogue? And we'll start with Kate Nelson, managing editor of the Albuquerque Tribune.
Pay attention.
Dr. Guy Burgess, co-director of the Conflict Research Consortium at the University of Colorado.
I think the key is to focus on persuading others that your view of the world makes sense, but at the same time being willing to be persuaded yourself.
Dr. Gil St. Clair, a lecturer in political science at the University of New Mexico.
Well, I don't think I can improve on what Guy has just said in terms of trying to persuade others that you mean well and accepting the fact that they may mean well as well, and even though their views are different. We need a trust and we need an acceptance of the basic good intentions of our fellow citizens if we're to have a civil discourse.
What are a few websites, books, or resources that offer some more information on civility and politics? Guy, do you have any?
Well, we've been working on a project we call beyondintractability.org, which is an online encyclopedia of information, including hundreds of pages of articles and thousands of links and over 100 hours of audio on strategies for dealing with really difficult and tractable conflicts in a more constructive way.
Anybody else?
I don't have websites. I just have an encouragement that if apparently the notion of reading a newspaper a day is daunting to some people, I would suggest perhaps perusing at least one newspaper a day. And again, balance out your diet. Try different points of view and round out, find out how other people are thinking, and be willing to live in that gray area where this candidate's right on this issue, that candidate's right on that issue. I'm willing to change my mind on this other issue.
Gil?
There's one interesting book which I think is useful now, and it's Tom Patterson's The Vanishing Voter, which sort of details some of these structural changes which could be made which might improve the entire involvement of citizens.
Great. We'll list those as well as some other links and materials on our website, which is peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. Our program is produced by Good Radio Shows Incorporated. Producer and engineer is Paul Ingalls. Engineering assistance from Joel Edelstein and KGNU, Boulder, Colorado. Music by Bob Dylan and Ali Edelman. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Thanks for listening.